Welcome to Word Labs Out Loud, your weekly writing spark on CFRC 101.9. This week, we will be presenting part one of a conversation that happened during this summer's Skeleton Park Arts Festival. As part of their programming, they offered a panel workshop called From Page to Stage, Voicing Your Verse, facilitated by Word Labs Ara McCauley and featuring Skeleton Park Arts Festival headliner Cadence Weapon, also known as Rolly Pemberton, former Edmonton Poet Laureate, Kingston's current Poet Laureate, Sadiqa Demeyer, and local vocalist, poet, and spoken word artist, Jay Marsh, aka Jermaine Marshall. In this panel, all three artists discussed how they develop and use their verse, from writing poems to developing lyrics and flowing between genres. This free event encouraged everyone with a creative spark to get writing without worrying about doing it wrong.
So great to have everyone here today, including a wonderful community that has come out to be a part of this discussion with us. Claps for the community! Clap for yourself! So let's just dive right in. I had sent a bunch of questions. We can follow them, we can not follow them, you know, wherever we want to go with this. But I always like asking this question around what we talk about and why. You know, we're all creatives, we're all picking things to have discussions about through our art, through our mediums. Why do you pick the things that matter enough that you feel, I gotta talk about this in this stage, on this medium, in this way, and not just, oh, I'm gonna think about this, but I'm not gonna talk about this.
Yeah, I mean, I don't necessarily decide what I'm going to work on. It's just kind of what ends up in the atmosphere around me and the things that I'm just interested in. But I won't be like, today I'm going to make a political song. Like, it doesn't really work like that. But it's really just like an accumulation of little ideas here and there. Like, it's kind of magpie style, and eventually comes together, and then it's like, oh, this song is about government surveillance. You know.
So the process isn't necessarily defined as you're going through it. It's kind of when it clicks that it clicks.
Yeah, it's like, well, the way my process is, I'll just like write down little notes on my phone a lot, and I'll kind of have them in different places where it's like, okay, a lot of these are maybe around like one particular theme, and it's just things that come to my mind, and like once I notice that it's somewhat substantial, I'm like, okay, let me like see if I can put these ideas together.
I see. So Sadiqa, how do you start curating for creation?
I think we're on a similar page. Yeah, I use a notebook, not a phone, but other than that, with masking tape tabs for the themes. Yeah, I do believe, like, I don't think we choose our material. I think it comes, and it's the subjects that sort of preoccupy us, keep coming back. And I do, like, if I've made a conscious choice to write about something, it usually goes wrong. Because I feel like what's actually in there that wants to come out, will, it'll tell you, and it'll be like, I'm not part of it yet, so bring me in. So I don't spend too much time considering, what am I gonna write about? It just is, it's clear, it's there, it's the things you're always thinking about.
So oftentimes I think back to one of my earliest poems, just again, kid, that moment where I was like, oh, I'm really upset about this thing that just happened, and so I want to write about this thing that just happened in this form of writing that I've just started to learn about in high school. It's like, oh, I like how the words are aligned here. And I find that with my creative process, oftentimes it's the things that people don't want to talk about, that's what tends to hook my attention. Because since I was a kid, I was like in, you know, Jamaica, queer kid, realizing that, oh, I want to ask these questions, but people don't want to talk about it. But I want to talk about it. So that's where I find a lot of how my process starts is, what is it that I want to talk about that people don't want to talk about? So let me make a way that, like, I can talk about it and kind of compel them into the conversation as an audience.
But then there are, like, decisions about privacy or, like, safety, all those, you have to weigh things about that, right?
That's interesting. I feel like any time in my process, when I come up against something and I write something down or say something, I'm like, oh, I don't know if I should say that, or I think I've gone too far, or like, oh, I have like a weird feeling about it. Now, it's really important for me to lean into that feeling. And that means I've found some kind of fertile territory. Like, there's something kind of uneasy, something that's like, makes me question it, that might make other people question it and think about it. So I'm like, okay, this is the way I need to go, you know?
Like, the discomfort is a signal to follow.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So is part of the function of your art to make people uncomfortable? I'm not trying to put words in your mouth, sounded a little suspect.
Yeah, like, in a way, like, I think it's really just about different perspectives and seeing things from different angles. And I do want to help other people see the world differently and maybe see outside of themselves a little bit. So if in that process people feel uncomfortable, then that I guess
but that's what I'm trying to do. Isn't that process an inherently uncomfortable process? Because we're comfortable in ourselves. So it's
Are we? That's a good question. Because I don't know. I don't think I always am.
We're complacent in ourselves and we read that complacency as comfort.
Sure.
Does that work for you? I get what you're saying.
Yeah.
And so I think a lot of people in that complacency when, you know, especially in your work talking about immigration, and I know when you wrote about This Is Alphabet, kind of that journey being in that liminal space, not everybody is comfortable being in that liminal space of language or just of identity. But tell us about Alphabet, that piece of work of yours, and maybe how it relates to this idea of our art asking people to experience the world outside of themselves.
Okay. That's a book I wrote. Alphabet, Alphabet, which is about my transition from speaking Dutch to English, which I made as about, I was about 12 years old when we moved here. And so leaving one language behind and adopting another, and what did that feel like? Which actually, interestingly, is not, like 20% of Canadians are in that same boat. So it's not actually that much of a minority experience that they don't speak French or English as or an Indigenous language as their first language. So I found not so much that people are reading it and thinking, oh, I've never thought of that before, but more like, oh yeah, that happened to me, or my parents or my grandparents, you know, spoke a different language. I'm thinking of, you know, there's this quote about writing that is misattributed all the time, so I won't even try to say who said it, but it was, it's like writing should disturb the comfortable and comfort the disturbed, have you? So like that has this dual valency for, depending who's reading.
Can you say that one more time?
Listening. Writing should disturb the comfortable and comfort the disturbed.
So speaking of disturbing the comfortable and comforting the disturbed, when I was growing up, you know, and I grew up in the church, so all that rap music, oh Lord, that hippity hop, you know, Satan's Jives was oftentimes seen as negative, seen as something that was disturbing the comfort. And that's a medium that you sometimes use, you're known for dabbling in.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Why did you pick it?
Well, I feel like it picked me. You know, I mean, it was just, I was born to rap. It's like my dad was a radio DJ, and he played radio. He was one of the first people to introduce hip-hop music to Edmonton, where I'm originally from. So he had a radio show called The Black Experience and Sound. And he had it for over 20 years on the radio there. So I kind of grew up in a library of music, and particularly rap was just always around me, right? So it seems pretty natural that I would get into it, but it was just something I always found it really interesting how the different rappers, they all had different voices, different ways of flowing, different, it was like their handwriting.
Yeah, creative identity.
I felt like I would hear songs where people would talk about things that you didn't hear in other kinds of music or in other art forms, really. You would talk about politics or talk about like socio-political things, and that really excited me a lot. Like a lot of the underground rap, which maybe is not as objectionable as some of the more mainstream stuff. That's really what I grew up on.
It's interesting. I find that oftentimes when I was growing up and I'd have conversations with people about like a song, and like, oh, this song is so great, and the messaging, and like, what do you mean about the messaging? It's just nice to listen to. And I'm like, oh, okay. So there are a lot of times where people are engaging at different levels of the medium that's and just the content that's sort of being sent to them. And I think that's, you know, growing up in the Caribbean, reggae is another really big socially conscious commentary while also sounding very good. It's entertaining. But I was talking to a friend of mine about how part of the colonial machine is it locks the music into just being entertaining. And so if you're trying to like say, oh no, there's more to this, it's like, well no, the curtains are just blue. It's just for entertainment. It's just this one thing.
Yeah, you know, you can, it's unfortunate, but it's like, you can't control it, right? And I feel like I do what I can to try and make things that are appealing on multiple levels, like as many as like, you know, I'm really into double and triple entendres and lyrics, and like I'm just trying to make things for just different people to cue into. Like some people are really super lyrical, some people like want it as a body experience, like it's just purely physical. So I try and have a balance as much as I can, but I can't control the societal factors that make people assume that you make rap so it's more like for driving in your car.
So here's a question, I guess. Oh, sorry, were you about to say something? Oh, okay. No, I call it my teacher eyes on, which is where, if anybody's shoulder moves to my left, I'm just like, is that a hand? Is that a hand over there?
Okay, I could show something that, yeah. Maybe
something
that
I thought so, like, I saw it, I saw
yeah,
it,
yeah,
go.
You did. You saw a flicker.
I saw it.
Okay, something I wrote about fairly recently was the work of the visual artist Surinder Dhaliwal. So she had a show with the AGO retrospective, and I was thinking about the role of beauty in her work. Because it's very beautiful, it's very colorful and charismatic and sort of appealing, and you want to get closer to it. But, you know, this is a thought that I borrowed and continued from another artist, Rajni Ferreira, who wrote about her work. And she talks about how that beauty works on different levels depending on who's looking. So, because actually what's also embedded in the works is like an anti-colonial critique, and it's all about the consequences of particularly like India's partition and the diaspora that arose from that. So if you're looking at it and you don't know that history, the beauty is pulling you in. It's like, and then you learn. Then you learn the history, you learn the consequences of these things that maybe your own people did, right? But if you're
the
looking...
The beauty that pulls you in challenges your whole idea of beauty.
Yes.
Sorry.
Yeah. But it's a spoonful of sugar. I don't know, like it helps, right? But the same work, you're standing in front of it and maybe that is your experience. You are that diasporic group. Then the beauty is like a balm, like it's medicine for you, you know, because you're seeing this trauma history embedded, like almost transmuted through the beauty. But it's the same work. And so I don't know if that's part of what you're saying, like that those layers, it depends who's looking, but it can be the same work having very different effects.
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah.
Totally.
And I think medicine is something that can hurt as it heals. I think that's something that people... As I've gotten into, you know, football or soccer, I have to call it both depending on who I'm talking to and which country I am in. Yeah. I said soccer once in Jamaica when I was back a few weeks ago and they did not respond well. But as I started playing that, I've been thinking a lot more about this idea of as your body goes through that, those physical activities, it may hurt, it may get sore, but it is building itself. I think sometimes in the age of comfort, people think discomfort is a negative inherently, as opposed to this perspective that draws me in with its beauty, but it's also causing me to feel uncomfortable about the things I used to like. It's causing me a certain level of distress. This is still medicine. Because, you know, what was it that Winston on New Girl said? Oh, you're like rubbing alcohol. You sting me in the now, but you help me in the later.
Mm. Yeah, I was going to say, you ever have Buckley's before?
I have grown to love the taste of Buckley's.
I think it's kind of nasty at first, but it works.
It works! Nothing works better than Buckley's.
There we go.
And it tastes like it works.
Yes, it definitely, it tastes like it works.
It looks strong too, like it looks like tar. I remember seeing it on a spoon as a kid and being like, is this oil? Is this medicine oil, mother?
So to write a poem like Buckley's, that's that's what we want.
So I did want to say that, you know, because our audience is here with us this afternoon, I wanted to pause midway to see if maybe there were any questions percolating in their minds based on the conversation so far. Remember, questions end with a question mark. you can still make a comment if you just wanted to make a comment, but if you say it's a question mark, people, we are literary folks this afternoon. But any questions? Anyone want to?
I do have one. I was curious about
identify yourself first. You know who we are. Who are you?
Hi, I've got a habit of making friends and then introducing myself. I'm Megan, and I'm not really officially in the art space, but my question is about your discussion on aesthetics is interesting to me because people seem to put aesthetics as just a visual experience, and really it's much more somatic than that. Like being drawn in is more than just seeing, you know. So I was just wondering kind of how you deal with a society which might think of art as like a surface level, like aesthetic layer, when really the aesthetics of art is more beyond that. So I was just wondering like how you reckon with a society that might see art as a commodity when really you're working with art as perhaps an experience.
I'm just trying to marinate on that. I think for me, I deal with that with world building, I think. Just I do a lot of stuff outside of just the art, just the music, to inform what I'm doing, so it isn't just like you come to the album and it's like, oh, this person just makes music or whatever. It's just like elevator music or whatever. And there's all this other stuff that kind of, I write a newsletter that I email people, and I'll write essays about the individual songs and kind of talk. I'll even include like a syllabus of like things I read or watched or whatever that influenced me. And then it's kind of, it informs people so much on just the overarching idea around music. Mm. So I just try and do that as much as I can with any of my projects.
One of the things that you said that really jumped out to me is, I oftentimes think of music, which is an art, which is storytelling, as an educational process, but I'm oftentimes surprised at the ways in which people who do it don't add that intentional pedagogical educational lens and framing to it. Mm-hmm. So again, it's kind of like, oh no, here's the art. Figure it out. And I'm like, well, no, you're dealing with a global audience. People are going to come into it at different points in time. There's a reason why people love to look up, like, well, what did the creator think? What is their saying? Like a book where you're like, well, what did the author mean? Or when you're talking about a comic book fight about who would win, Superman or Goku, like how much, you know, you look that stuff up. And I like that you seem to provide part of that framing for people to enter into the art, to see the aesthetic and not just the consumerism. But again, because I know you also write, so you've seen kind of that educational space, and you're going to be a Word Lab seminar facilitator as well coming up. Word Labs, learn more about it. What do you think about it?
Well, you know what? That's making me think of ostensibly what we're here to talk about, mm-hmm. is page to stage, right? Mm-hmm. The voicing of poems. And I work more on the page. In fact, sometimes I help people do the reverse, right? Where I'm mentoring poets who are spoken word poets, and like, how do you keep the life in the work when it's becoming a page-based thing? And I find often when I'm mentoring more emerging poets, I'm saying the opposite actually, which, you know, so you've got me thinking about it, where I'm saying, okay, like when you show me this poem and then tell me about it, I get a full picture in the round, it's beautiful, but it's not there in the poem. I needed your story. And for me, I mean, as much as possible, the art should do that work. And then, of course, I'm Googling those things too, and like, it is enriching to hear what happened around it, right? If I write an essay, I've got references that aren't just, this is what I cited, but similarly, like maybe this is what I watched or listened to or thought of. But like, to me, I think it's because of the technology of the book that I work with. Like, you're alone with it. The writer isn't there. It has to do the work.
How much work do you expect of the reader, of the viewer? Like, what is their labor in interacting with the text?
So, fortunately, whatever happens between you and a piece of writing is what happens, right? It can be enough to just have one line resonate and that you walk away with, or you can decipher it word by word and be really, so that's, I'm not particular about like how much are people getting, you don't have to understand what it, like if something's there for you, right? But yeah, within literature, that's a consideration of like some writers expect a lot of deciphering, right? It was Bloomsday the other day, like, James Joyce makes you work rather hard. But I mean, I do think that like reading is a collaboration that way.
Yeah.
It's your mind meeting their mind, and something is made
something
together,
which
is exciting.
So, and to that effect, and it was one of the questions that I was really interested in getting into, what happens where the meaning that you created, and again, let's say you put it in to make it clear, and you know, you're conveying it, and then when it hits the ears of multiple people, you know, what they each take away and then declare about the thing becomes very different. Because I remember, like, when I was young, early poem was about, I called it Liquid Love, Why Can't I Hold You Ever Falling Through Glass Fingers. It was meant to be about love and, you know, how elusive it was. A friend of mine read it and I said, oh, this is a great poem about alcoholism. I'm like, oh, the sound as you hit the floor. And I was like, oh, yeah, no, this works way, but yes, that's what it was about originally. But I mean, again, love, alcoholism, you know, the way that those mesh. But that was an instance where it was like, oh, actually, I like this meaning that you're adding to the work. Versus if someone had said, oh, so this is about puddles and rivers. I'm like, no, go away. Wrong. So how do you, I guess, navigate that? This idea of like people misinterpreting your work or your meaning.
But these folks get to hear me all the time, so.
Well, this happens to me a lot, because as a musician, you know, it's like people hear what they want to hear. But I feel like as soon as you've created something and you put it out into the world, like I feel like I lose ownership of it completely, and it becomes whatever you want it to be, how you want to interface with it, and you know, I have my opinion about what I decided to do. but I can't really control how you're going to engage with it. So it doesn't bother me.
I have a fun question.
Yeah.
Fun for me, I don't know if you'll find it fun. But again, you know, no one has to answer any questions that they don't want. You can pass. This is like on Jeopardy or any game show, you can pass. Mm-hmm. But this isn't a game show. There is no prize for you at the end. That's just the prize of our company. But I agree with losing ownership. But does one lose stewardship of the art? And are those two different things? Ownership versus stewardship? Because oftentimes, and this is, I've been shadow writing a few pieces, getting ready to publish around like parenting and what parenting is it, you know, it's not an ownership, even though again, it's oftentimes framed that way. It's a stewardship, but it's a collective stewardship. You know, it takes a village. We all have a level of stewardship over a new life that enters. It's just that I like to frame it as parents are the immediate stewards of the child, of the, you know, new life. And so if as artists we are the, let's say, immediate stewards of this, there can be wider stewardship. Does that stewardship continue after you've released it? And what might that look like if you think it continues? But again, this is me making a framework that is of interest to me.
Yeah, that's interesting. I feel like I would say, and I think maybe you'll agree with me, that I am a vessel, right? And when these... I just put myself in the best position to get an idea, and I translate that idea as it comes through me, you know. And for me, getting into the best position for that is, you know, I try and be healthy. Mm. I drink a lot of water.
I've just gotten on the, was not drinking enough.
Do you drink smoothies?
So many fruit shakes in the morning.
I have a smoothie every morning.
You know? Same.
I'm writing a book right now, and the smoothie is like putting in work.
Turns out the body is most, a lot of it is water. Who knew?
Or it's like, or being active, or like forward motion, like running, like driving, even like
that's when you're more receptive.
Yeah, it feels like it's my antenna's up. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I just feel like the ideas just come through me, and it's like up to me to be in the position to catch them and translate them to the rest of the world. But then after it's come out, like it's just the weirdest thing because. You don't know what's going to happen to something once you put it out into the world. Like I have this one song about this hockey player, Connor McDavid, I have a song about. And I'm originally from Edmonton. I was like, it has like other meaning for me. Like it was like actually a bit of a metaphor like about like my own career. But it outwardly, no one would ever like clock that.
Until now,
right? But the interesting thing about this song is it really has been resonating a lot with young people, like children. And like schools in Edmonton have started, somebody sent me a video of like an entire school choir and like in band like playing my song.
That's awesome.
And I was like, I did not make this for children at all. I was envisioning the guy like tailgating like outside of the game or whatever in the truck or whatever that. But then it ended up being like this other thing and I'm like, okay, that's great.
That's a really good point about how when you're channeling the universe and just experiences, you never know who it's going to resonate with. I wonder, have you ever had a moment where art you've made has resonated unexpectedly, audience-wise, or in a way that surprised you in terms of who was really kind of picking up on what you were putting down?
Sure, like, yeah, I can't think of a specific example at this moment, but I know I've had instances where someone approaches me and I've learned to drop my assumptions of where demographically I might think we're not on, you know, we have nothing in common. And then they'll say something about what they read and how it, like, oh, I was mistaken. Yeah. That's a beautiful thing about art. Yeah.
It bridges.
It does, yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting, part of the artistry that I do, I oftentimes say that it's more me going through my memory and storytelling and pulling together, like, whether it's gospel music, whether it's poetry, whether it's Caribbean-style storytelling, just me trying to put you in my bedroom.
Cool.
Yes.
Yeah.
Have there been times where...
Who are you? Introduce yourself first. We're working on this
here. My name is Oliver. I'm an aspiring musician. But my question was, have there ever been times where the audience's response to a piece has changed the way that you look back at it in the future?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah. 100%.
Yes. There is... Do you mind if I...
Yeah, you go first, yeah.
So I grew up in Jamaican Pentecost, which was a very difficult experience as a queer, racialized person who was aware of colonialism and all the wildness of being in the Caribbean. And I wrote a poem about the ways in which, like, oftentimes in church when kids were being disobedient or chaotic, they'd get, like, slaps and, like, etc. So it was a poem about that, which again is a common thing across a lot of religious communities, this idea of children should be seen and not heard, and not responding well to the fact that this is a developing nervous system. They're supposed to make noise and sounds and engage with the world around them. So I made a poem about it that was also meant to convey the complexity of the people doing the beating as well, and the fact that it became like it's such a cultural thing. The choir singing while it's happening, the sermon going on, everybody kind of knows what's going on, but doesn't talk about it, but it affects relationships. Because again, it was specifically like a Black community environment. And then when I did it for a while in Canada, I didn't like how people vilified the people in the narrative or demonized them or kind of said, oh my God, it wasn't great that people went through this, but the focus on that without the appreciation of the greater, like, oh no, this is a story about humanity and the kind of mistakes that even you could be in a system like this. So I kind of shelved that poem for a while because I didn't like people thinking about those people in my life in that way. Mm-hmm. And I didn't like being the progenitor of that thought. Mm-hmm. So yes, their reaction did make me go back to it. And I'm looking forward to trying to tweak it so the message is maybe a little bit clearer in terms of the nuances. But
that's very interesting how it shifted meanings.
Yeah, especially as I've gotten older and, you know, my father passed away recently. And so I was in a Christian grieving ceremony, funeral, etc. And I was again reminded of that humanity piece. I'm like, ooh, I can't do this poem again until I've really reworked it or at least packaged it in a way where it better conveys that complexity. Maybe people will still misinterpret, but then that misinterpretation will be more on them than on the fact that I didn't do my best to humanize in this narrative.
Interesting, yeah.
Tune in to Word Labs Out Loud next week for part 2 of From Page to Stage, Voicing Your Verse, featuring Cadence Weapon, Jay Marsh, and Siddiqui Demir. Here's Cadence Weapon with TLDR to wrap up this week's show.
My hero never read a book, that's the first thing they took. Taking away our language just to make us less dangerous. Corporations put their hooks in us, then they watch and let us dangle. Throw the book at you, a scandal. Throw my words up like a vandal. White walls in the gallery, stare like I'm part of the action. Lose your life over a caption, capsize. Now look who's the captain. Hard to tell who's real and who's capping. Capitalism in action, camera flash, camouflage in the answers. Cars and mansions gone in a flash, got you asking what happened. Karma coming right back because of your stances. I read too much, get stuck out of balance, just like a flying Walinda. Life like a beauty pageant, mood enhancing beverage too advanced. Performative compassion, viral dances, better image capture on a search for perfect matches. Bad faith reading, but your fans got your back no matter what happens. They crowdfund scammers who are always claiming they're fighting the masters, lining their pockets, happening often, signing petitions, and constantly reaping the profits. Obnoxious, like cops who treat taxpayers like corporate sponsors. No amount of propaganda will make me forget about all of the trauma. And everyone online wanna mine it for commas. Trauma farmers barter for my soul in bulk when I try to argue. Harder and harder to know what side of the wall I'm onto. My DMs filled with racists. To them, Black death's a celebration, and Black life is more of a provocation. Merchants of death masquerade as press. Got pound of flesh, they'll pay it. Livestream my grandma's wake, I wish I could've made it. Don't hate the game, I just hate the way they play it. Regurgitating disinformation, bench warmers trying to score points while remaining nameless, never citing sources, unbothered, staying faceless, tasteless tastemaker, never make a stand, clout chaser, cows to slaughter, always bragging about their brand, so remorseless. Streaming apps use my catalog to leave me voiceless. Posthumous release, only time I'll get promoted. Couldn't find relief, I couldn't find my focus. Did some therapy, finally got sober. All I want is peace and space to grow older with my family until it's all over. Remember when they used to call me Rollercoaster? Too long didn't read when I made this post.